Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From OutsideOutline.com. It's fall, y'all. Are you getting into your pumpkin spice lattes? Are you getting into those tall fall boots?
I mean, maybe when it gets cold outside, not yet. Right.
Well, even if it hasn't gotten cold outside, the leaves have started dropping. And this is the perfect year to stop raking your leaves up because it's pointless and it's bad for your yard. Ecologists say we need to rethink what a beautiful or well-maintained yard looks like because lawns make up 44 million acres, and that's the U.S. alone. That's more than double the acreage of all of our national parks combined.
Wow.
It is basically an ecological dead zone. It doesn't support any of the essential functions like pollination, carbon sequestration, nutrient recycling, all of the stuff that, you know, sustains life on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And according to a study by NatureServe, more than a third of species and ecosystems in the U.S. are at risk of disappearing. And this kind of biodiversity loss, this would be catastrophic for us. But natural landscapes are way less cost and time intensive to maintain. And even better, it's great news for all of the bugs, birds, bees that are critical for biodiversity and also just plain fun to watch. We're in our maybe sixth year of trying this, and it is a slow process, but the number of lizards we've seen in our yard, in our sunroom this year, I feel like Snow White of Texas right now. And if this information is helpful to anybody, I went to the National Wildlife Federation website where you can certify your wildlife backyard online.
Huh.
There is a nominal fee, but all you have to do is provide 3 sources of food, and that can include different pollinating plants. It has to have a water source, and then sources for shelter, which can be as easy as, can you throw a log against a corner somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're certified, you can put that in your lawn so that when the code guy comes around again to find you, you can say, hey, I've got this certified, and it's registered, and it's now code exempt.
See, I've never even thought about this. We have a ton of lizards around our house, and I just assumed it was like, oh, we live in a great area for lizards, but I'm now realizing it's because I do zero effort in my lawn.
What you've done by doing nothing is let all of the plants do what they naturally do, which is what the bugs are looking for. And the more bugs you have, the more lizards you're going to have eating them. So yeah, this is as simple as do nothing, y'all. But if you have to do something, and sometimes that is warranted, think about leaves not as litter. And this is from Matthew Shepard, the director of outreach and education at the Xerces Society. He says, leaves provide critical food and shelter for butterflies, beetles, bees, moths, other invertebrates, and we need to stop thinking of these tiny creatures as pests, but rather as heroes. Insects are critical to us because they transfer pollen, right? They're pollinators, we're seeing them in decline. Without these pollinators and enough habitat for them, our global food supply could be dramatically diminished, right? Not only that, leaf debris helps to build healthy soil, and healthy soil can hold moisture. So, okay, if you have a lot of leaves and you do have to manage them somewhat, here's how to get the most of them. Don't blow leaves into a pile to bag, blow them into your flower beds. That way they can create wildlife habitat. They'll eventually decompose and become the mulch you would otherwise be spreading on them.
Hmm.
If you have leaves left over, mow it down as mulch and they'll actually feed your lawn if a lawn is something that you want to have.
Okay, because if you just blow big chunky leaves into there, you make a mosquito habitat.
Well, you know, we are talking about nature and, you know.
I like nature right up until it gives me malaria. Like,
that's
there's
fair.
A line, you know?
Super fair. Super fair. Boundaries are healthy, right? Just think about a different way of doing things this year.
Well, I appreciate the justification to keep being lazy and doing what I was doing. So thank you.
You were supporting nature. That's the frame. You're supporting nature.
Yeah,
and check out that certification if you're getting any heat from anybody.
I will. I might. You never know. I think all my neighbors don't care either. But but it'll be good to know because I do have an HOA in my area. So we'll keep an eye out.
My sympathies. All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Forbes, and it's titled New Gmail Security Alert for 2.5 Billion Users as AI Hack Confirmed.
Cool.
Yeah, we're at that point in the timeline already. So Google has implemented increasingly sophisticated protections against those who would compromise your Gmail account, but hackers using AI-driven attacks are also evolving. Sam Mitrovic, a Microsoft solutions consultant, has issued a warning after almost falling victim to what is described as a super realistic AI scam call capable of tricking even the most experienced of users. He recounts in a blog post warning other Gmail users of the threat in question, "I received a notification to approve a Gmail account recovery attempt. The need to confirm an account recovery or a password reset is a notorious phishing attack methodology intended to drive the user to a fake login portal where they need to enter their credentials to report the request as not initiated by them. So far, so relatively straightforward and easy to avoid. Then, almost exactly a week later, the fun started in earnest, another notification request for account recovery approval followed by a telephone call 40 minutes later. An American voice claiming to be from Google support confirmed that there was suspicious activity on the Gmail account. He asks if I'm traveling, Mitrovic said. When I said no, he asks if I logged in from Germany, to which I reply no. The so-called Google support person informed Mitrovic that an attacker had accessed his Gmail account for the past 7 days and had already downloaded account data. This rang alarm bells as Mitrovic recalled the recovery notification from a week earlier. Googling the phone number he was being called from while speaking, Mitrovic discovered that it did indeed lead to Google business pages. Now, that is a good heuristic. If you get a phone call from Google and it's a human being, it's a scam.
Right.
They don't care.
They do not care about you. Yep.
Yeah. So some more types of fraud that we've been seeing is fraudsters have also been seen abusing Google Forms to create legitimate looking documents sent as part of support scams. The document is sent via genuine Google servers, which adds legitimacy to the scam. One such scam used such a form to mimic an account recovery password reset form, telling the target they would get an SMS notification from a named support agent and giving them the number to check. This double legitimacy method is enough to fool plenty of people lots of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to be familiar with Google Forms, because if you've used those before, you're like, oh, like literally anybody can make these. But if you've never encountered one before, you know, it's completely Google branded.
Right.
So lessons to be learned here. Mitrovic did the right thing, or at least the next best thing, to hang up and ask the supposed support guy to send an email confirmation, an email which arrives soon after from a Google domain and looking for all intents and purposes genuine. At this point, he noticed the to field contained a cleverly disguised address that wasn't actually a Google domain, but could once again easily fool those not of a technical bent. The real giveaway for Mitrovic, however, was when the caller said hello and after no response said hello again. Mitrovic said, "At this point, I realized the pronunciation and spacing were too perfect." So, in terms of staying safe from these advanced Gmail scams, AI deepfakes are not just used for porn and politics. They're also used to perpetrate seemingly straightforward account takeovers, such as in this case. So if you're approached by someone claiming to be from Google support, stay calm. They won't phone you, so that's a massive red flag right away.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing bad will happen if you hang up. Use the tools at your disposal, including Google Search itself, ironically, and your Gmail account to make checks during the call if you're concerned. Search the phone number. And the article doesn't say this, but anytime you see any sort of recovery or login screen, check the URL. Always check the URL. If it doesn't come from google.com, it's probably a scam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also just don't answer your phone. Like that's the,
yeah.
Like just don't go fully hermit. And that's the greatest solution ever.
Yeah. Have y'all gotten an actual AI robocall yet? Like a deepfake voice one?
I have, but only for spam. Like they were trying to sell stuff.
Yeah, I got the one that said hello twice, and
mm-hmm.
on the second time, you're like, ooh, that audio is crystal clear and pronounced like somebody who, well, perhaps was trained on millions of megabytes of audio data.
Mm-hmm.
like, absolutely perfect and uncanny, and then I was just like, oh, God, we're here, huh?
Well, and they're moving towards video.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
You'll get a
yeah.
FaceTime, and it'll look like the person. We're 90% of the way there. If you're on your iPhone, you're 100% of the way there.
Yeah.
Now, I will mention a bit of a tangent, but if you want some vicarious justice using the exact same tools, I personally really love Kit Boga on YouTube. Mm-hmm. He's a scam baiter. And so basically, he will just waste people's time and tie up scam lines. And sometimes, like, he actually works with Kraken, the crypto exchange, to find people's servers and their accounts, like scammers, and shut them down. And he also works with other people like TeamViewer, which is a common tool that scammers will use. But recently, he's graduated. Now he's so big, he has an entire company, like a team that does this. And they've built like an AI-powered system of like automated phone lines that bounces scammers back and forth, promising that they'll get their Bitcoin soon if they just go through this Byzantine process, and keeps them tied up for literally days. Like, watching it, it's so torturous. You have to like remind yourself that they're criminal scammers.
These are the bad guys.
Yeah. But it's also extremely funny and very well-produced content. So if you like that kind of thing or it sounds interesting, Kit Boga on YouTube, I'd recommend that. Next link.
Next link.
This comes from Food and Wine. California just became the first state to ban sell-by dates. It's a bit hyperbolic here. It's language changing. So the law prohibits the use of consumer-facing sell-by dates and also requires standardization language for date labels.
So the idea is that there's still an expiration date. There's just not this made-up sell-by date a couple of weeks before that.
Correct. Any food product with a date label, with the exception of infant formula, eggs, beer, and malt beverages, must state, quote, best if used by, and, quote, used by, to designate food safety. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, there aren't any federal requirements for the language on food date labels outside of baby formula.
Right. They're like, this really matters. We need to be on top of this one.
So this has produced a wide range of words and phrases that are employed, including options like display until, freshest by, or best before. So without consistent standards, customers are often confused by what these labels actually mean. Mm-hmm. So much so that Food and Wine magazine even published a guide to interpreting them. And we'll end up, and I know I've done it, throwing out food or not purchasing the food that is perfectly fine to eat.
Yeah. See, and on the flip side, I've literally known someone who was like, you could see the food was spoiled. And he was like, no, the expiration date is tomorrow, so this is fine. I was like, no, but smell it. And like, I had a whole argument with him, and then he ate it and got sick. So, you know, that was his punishment. But
right, because these dates are unnecessary. Although, I have to admit, best if used by, I still don't like that. That's still a little bit too gray.
Yeah,
how steep
best.
Is the curve I mean, of like, going bad?
Yeah, that's still implying, like, you could eat it, it just won't taste as good. Like, there's a difference between that and it's now poison.
It's condescending. Mm-hmm. It's needlessly condescending. Don't food shame me.
Right, because it's, you know, it's a seemingly a small shift, but apparently, according to ReFed, a nonprofit organization fighting food waste, they estimate that about 78 million tons, or 33% of all food in the United States, goes to waste.
Wow.
Yeah.
In California specifically, ReFed calculates that almost 12 million tons of food were wasted in 2022.
Man.
And of course, the problem is much more than just edible food that isn't being utilized.
Right.
The EPA calculates that food waste makes up roughly 24% of materials discarded in landfills. Decaying food then produces methane as it breaks down. Mm. And we all know how awful methane is.
Ugh.
ReFed details that in 2021, surplus food accounted for 380 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent.
Yikes.
That's 6% of total U.S. GHG emissions, the annual equivalent of driving 84 million passenger vehicles or powering 73 million homes with electricity. So retailers, households, we all eat that cost too.
Ugh.
The good news, we can take small steps to reduce food waste at home. Donate your items that are still good to eat. Compost. It does create methane, but it's a heck of a lot less. And you know what? Go ahead and drink that six-month-old milk. I'm sure it's fine.
It's probably fine.
Chunky is good. I'm sorry. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I've got a fun one from The Conversation called Bees Have Irrational Biases When Choosing Which Flowers to Feed On, Just Like Human Shoppers Do.
Aw.
Cute. Yeah. So this article is written by one of the authors of the study, Claire Therese Hemingway, who is an assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Tennessee. And she says that while her research is all about decision-making in animals, she has found over the years that it matches perfectly with human decision-making, which is to say it is entirely irrational. So let's start with humans. Marketing experts have known for decades that people can be manipulated in what they buy, right? For example, if you give people a choice between a cheap refrigerator and an expensive one, consumers will be divided pretty evenly based on their own finances and needs. But if you add a third super luxury refrigerator, far more people will now be willing to buy the original, quote, expensive refrigerator because now it's in the middle. So it feels like a moderate choice, even though the price and quality haven't changed.
It's kind of like why they got rid of like medium drinks at like.
Yeah, they're like bumpy up to large. That's the only choice. And you can actually get the same effect with just two items in a different way, where researchers have put out a TV that is objectively overpriced, but people are more willing to pay it if there is an even smaller, more expensive TV right next to it because now it looks like a better deal. And it turns out that all of this applies to bees as well and which flowers they choose to eat from. And the key here is that flowers aren't a static product. You can get lower or higher quality nectar, and there's also some variance in how quickly the nectar flows from the plant. So to control all these factors, the researchers took a beehive and connected it by a tunnel to a big plastic chamber that was meant to represent a field of flowers. And on the far side of it, there are these little different colored interchangeable circles with a little feeding tube in the center of each one so the researchers could control both the flow and the sweetness of the nectar in each flower. So first, they gave the bees a bunch of blue flowers with really high quality nectar. Then they swapped them out for a mix of yellow and blue flowers, all with medium quality nectar. The bees were happy to drink from the medium yellow flowers, but they avoided the medium blue flowers, even though they were the exact same, because they had been taught to have higher expectations from the blue ones. In another trial, they gave the bees a choice between two colors, one of which was very sweet, but the nectar was very slow, while the other had low sweetness, but flowed very quickly. And between these two, the bees were pretty evenly divided. Both had their benefits and both were acceptable. But then they added a third color, which was basically a worse version of one of the other two. Either it flowed quickly but was even less sweet, or it was the same as the high sweet ones but flowed even slower. And in both cases, when that third worse flower was introduced, the bees started flocking to the one that was similar but better, and no longer paying attention to the one that was different, even though they liked them 50-50 when there was no third for comparison. And unlike a lot of weird but interesting science, this one actually has some pretty important uses, because bees are necessary to support $1 billion worth of crop growth every year. And if farmers are struggling to get their fields pollinated, one potential strategy would be to plant certain unattractive flower species next to the target crops to make those crops look more attractive in the marketplace.
Wow.
So yeah, bees are crazy. We're crazy. Everybody just wants to consume. That's the takeaway I'm getting.
For me, it's more that context plays a larger role in your decision-making that you're unaware of.
Right.
And that this is deeply embedded in DNA behavior.
Right.
Well, it seems that the default programming for best tends to be more, faster, concentration of that, right?
Yeah, there are no bees in the like low consumption ethical philosophies.
Where are the farm to table wildflowers? I actually want that delphinium that has slow flowing nectar, because that way you can really feel the relationship that plant had with the sun in producing the nectar.
Yeah, the bee lands on a flower and goes like, it tastes like a real flower, y'all.
It's artisanal.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, from EOS.org, new research is showing that earthquakes may lace quartz veins with gold.
Oh.
If you didn't already know, most of the world's gold nuggets come from veins of quartz found in ancient mountain belts. What happens is that hot solutions of water and dissolved elements migrate deeply into these regions when they were active. They deposit quartz along faults, fractures, and other rock boundaries. And then from these hydrothermal fluids, bits of gold are also crystallized. And until now, scientists had wondered how the gold could be concentrated enough to form such large nuggets. And we're talking like pebble to fist size. According to Chris Voicy, a geologist at Monash University in Australia, he says, because the solubility of gold is low in natural fluids, it would take a huge volume of fluid to make a gold nugget in a vein. for example, if there's one part per million of gold in some kind of solution, it would take 5 Olympic swimming pools of that fluid to form just a 22-pound chunk of gold.
Hmm.
So that's where the earthquakes are coming in. Earthquakes send seismic waves rippling through the earth, which compress and deform rocks. Now, quartz, which is a mineral made of silica, has a property known as piezoelectricity. When you stress quartz, say by an earthquake, it produces electrons and it generates voltage. Now, this voltage can play a role in some chemical reactions. And so Voisey and his colleagues were like, According to him, what I wanted to do was basically make an earthquake in the lab. So using a tool, kind of like an automated hammer, he pounded quartz crystals in a gold-bearing solution for an hour. And then when he looked at the crystals under the microscope, he saw tiny bits of metallic gold stuck to the quartz. According to Voisey, I went nuts. I was like jumping around the lab, throwing chairs. That's a direct quote. Now, and this is important, a quartz piece that had not been hammered did not show signs of gold metal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because this deposition of gold is an electrochemical process, the gold in solution prefers to glom onto metallic gold, which is an electrically conductive material, rather than quartz, which is an insulator and tends to trap charges rather than allow a current to flow. And this is exactly the type of mechanism to get gold out of solution. So, the place where orogenic gold deposits occurred, yeah, they would have experienced multiple low-magnitude earthquakes every day for between 10,000 and a million years. And that's what allowed the gold to build up nearly continuously. Right. So apocalypse conditions, listen, it's just making gold for some future civilization, right?
Yeah, what you're telling me is fracking is good.
Yeah, exactly. The more earthquakes you make, the more likely you're going to coagulate some gold underneath.
Hey, and we're pumping water down in there. Yeah, it's got all the things we need.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically talking about those little sand pounders in Dune. If there's any quartz in the sand, they're making little bitty balls of gold underneath every sand pounder.
That's cute.
And keeping the worms away. But, you know, like the Fremen need some gold too. That's fair.
It's more that the sandworms are producing the gold through huge thrashing tectonic level.
That's true. They're probably more like an earthquake than
right,
a sand
right.
pounder. You're right.
Yep. Next link?
Next link.
A little bit more cybersecurity content for us today. This article comes to us from Bleeping Computer. And it's titled, unfortunately, Internet Archive Hacked, Data Breach Impacts 31 Million Users.
Boo.
Yeah, I was reading about this.
Yeah. So thankfully, Web Archive is back online now, but I was really feeling the pain over the last few days because there were things I wanted to look up on the Web Archive. And I was like, where do I find a mirror of the Web Archive? The only source to mirrors was the Web Archive. You know, it's just a lot of data to host. So it really kind of underscored just how impactful that would be if Web Archive ever fully went down.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, Internet Archive's The Wayback Machine has suffered a data breach after a threat actor compromised the website and stole a user authentication database containing 31 million unique records. A JavaScript alert created by the hacker said, "Have you ever felt like the Internet Archive runs on sticks and is constantly on the verge of suffering a catastrophic security breach? It just happened. See 31 million of you on HIBP." The text HIBP refers to the Have I Been Pwned data breach notification service created by Troy Hunt, with whom threat actors commonly share stolen data to be added to the service. Hunt told Bleeping Computer that the threat actor shared the Internet Archive's authentication database 9 days ago, and it's a 6.4 gigabyte SQL file named ia_users.sql. The database contains authentication info for registered members, including their email addresses, screen names, password change timestamps, bcrypt hashed passwords, and other internal data. And a hashed password is basically when they take your actual password and run it through a one-way encryption algorithm. It can be reverse engineered, but it takes a long time to do so. And typically, you know, you just change your password. So if you happen to have an account there, definitely change your password. Hunt says there are 31 million unique email addresses in the database, with many subscribed to the HIBP data breach notification service. And it'll be soon be added to HIBP, allowing users to enter their email and confirm if their data was exposed in this breach. If you're not familiar with Have I Been Pwned, it's a really useful website. you have, like, right, just everybody has.
Yes.
Yeah. But you can specifically see what emails have been compromised on what sites, what services, and a lot of them are some of your favorite multi-billion companies that you mm-hmm. know and love and trust who do not protect your information security whatsoever. So earlier, the Internet Archive suffered a DDoS attack, which has now been claimed by the Black Meta hacktivist group, who says they will be conducting additional attacks. So that was a few days ago. Thankfully, everything is back up. But if we ever lost Web Archive, we would lose literally most of the internet.
Yeah.
Like, it's all there.
Decades.
Well, and I use it all the time for research. Mm-hmm. Like, not just the amount of data that they have up there just that's free for use, but also, like you said, the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
Looking at what a website looked like 10 years ago.
Historical
years
record.
Ago, you can see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's very, very helpful sometimes to be like, oh, look. In 2016, this major retailer changed some of the language on their website. Mm-hmm. Why would they have done that? You know, it's really, really useful to have some of that.
Yeah. And I mean, Wayback Machine, it's going to be difficult to download. Like, we'd have to pick
right?
and choose.
So much. Yeah.
It is 99 petabytes of data.
Oh, my gosh.
Which I believe a petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. So, yeah, your average computer can't handle that.
So we should print that out and store it in a backyard, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
All right, well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Math's Fundamental Flaw, Psychedelic Mushrooms Are Getting Much, Much Stronger, and Meet the Team Paid to Break into Top Secret Bases. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteresting week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.